I'm going to do this talk in English. Feel free to afterwards ask questions in German, but I figured I'd rather not flip-flop between languages, which is what I tend to do when I speak German, and instead consistently stay at one language. With that, welcome to the hybrid apocalypse. The two P's are on purpose. I'm not sure if you heard of that term, apocalypse, but it's basically that everything has to be an app today. So I kind of figured I'm going to jump on that wagon. Quickly introduction, my name is Dominic. I'm a developer evangelist for a company called Twilio. Quick show of hands, how many of you know what Twilio is? All right, cool, so I can introduce that. So Twilio is a cloud communications platform that allows you as a developer to easily add different means of communication, such as SMS, video, voice, voice over IP, chat, anything like that, into your applications by just using a simple set of REST APIs, and in some cases, client-side SDKs in the programming languages that you already know. But today, I'm not going to talk about that. Instead, as the title suggests, I'm going to talk to you about two words when combined really still cause panic attacks for some people, and that's hybrid apps. And we're going to dig a bit into why this is actually the case, as well as how what we can kind of do against this. But before we talk about that, we need to talk about what hybrid apps actually are, what I mean by hybrid apps. So typically, hybrid apps are kind of a fusion of two different types of technologies, two different types of apps coming together. In this case, it's the combination of native and web applications. What that means is that it's typically a user interface that is written using web technologies such as HTML, JavaScript, or CSS, and then it's loaded inside a web frame on the respective platform. And this web frame is then kind of in a shell that can be executed on the respective platform. So that will be on iOS, it will be an Objective-C or a Swift app, or it will be a UWP app that would load a web frame. Anything around that that allows you then to install this as a native app, even though you're loading web technology. And in some cases, these hybrid apps even have access to native functionality. So on mobile, that's typically through a project called Cordova or any kind of variations of that, such as PhoneGap or Ionic. And this basically achieves that you then have a JavaScript API that is plugin-based that allows you to access native functionality that you would else need to use with the respective languages on the platform. So that way you could, on iOS, use the Touch ID or receive push notifications, or anything really that is typically native functionality. All right, so that sounds all great. Why are people scared about this? So there are multiple reasons to this, and I'm going to dig into a couple of them. But I first want to talk to two people that definitely influenced this. And the first person is Steve Jobs. So when the first iPhone was announced, there was actually no concept of third-party native apps. There was no app store. The only idea was that, hey, you build lightweight mobile apps that you can load in Safari and then pin to your home screen. And that was it. And a lot of developers started developing these alternative, lightweight versions of their websites. So like you probably, websites still do this, where you end up on a website and say, hey, do you want to go to the mobile-friendly version, which then redirects to some other subdomain with a very lightweight version. So that was kind of the idea of where we're going with this. But then when the second iPhone was announced, Apple kind of backpedaled on this, and they were like, never mind, here's an app store. And there are certainly a couple of reasons, I think, that we can all think of why Apple thought an app store is a great idea. And instead of writing the apps in HTML5, how about you write them in Objective-C now? So that kind of happened, and developers were like, all right, cool, so never mind, let me just write everything in native now. So previously, you had a website that you could load with Edge connection even and just read the news. Now you had to download an app to via Wi-Fi at home to then read the news on the go. And this clearly showed like a switch of developer mindset in there. The other person is Mark Zuckerberg. So Facebook pretty quickly went on this trip of developing hybrid apps because for them it made sense. They were a web company that had one website that was massively successful, and they wanted to bring this to mobile. And as an approach to do so, they decided that hybrid apps are great because this way they could not only develop a normal website, they could develop a mobile website, as well as push the whole thing on iOS and Android. and use the tools and deployment mechanisms that they already had and that they were comfortable with, and that allowed them to not constantly go through the store approval of the respective stores. However, in 2012, Mark Zuckerberg went on stage at the TechCrunch Disrupt, and there he announced that effectively the whole strategy of building hybrid apps was their worst mistake on their mobile strategy. And the reason for that was that HTML5 just wasn't there yet. Nowadays, Facebook actually came up with their own solution to kind of get exactly what they needed, and that is called React Native, but that's a completely different story, so I'm not going to talk about that today. But if you want to have a chat, feel free to come to me after the talk, and we can have a chat about that. So what's the bottom line behind this? So I think both of these stories highlight that people are betting pretty early on HTML and web technology in general to kind of be a platform for the mobile. But the web, it wasn't just there yet. But that was 4 years ago, and the web evolves at such a rapid speed that since then a lot of stuff changed. A lot of new things came to the platform that are already supported on all platforms now that you can nicely use and build really good apps. However, just with life in general, bad things set tend to stick around longer than good things. So it's still kind of in the minds of people that hybrid apps are those really bad apps. And don't get me wrong, it's not like I'm saying that every app should be a hybrid app. There are certainly a lot of really good reasons to build native apps. One example is if you're planning to build a really high-performant app or game that really wants to get the last out of the hardware, totally go for native, because that way you can do the most improvements and the most fine-tuning on the performance. And if you can afford an army of developers on your team that can develop for all the platforms, go for it as well. I won't stop you. But there are certainly really good reasons for hybrid apps as well. One of the most typical ones is cross-platform support, because the market for for platforms is by now so vast. If you want to develop a mobile app and give users the chance to choose if they want to use your app and not restrict that by platform, you already have three platforms to deal with. If you then also want to serve the whole thing on desktop, well, you got three more, so you're at six. Unless you build a UWP app, then you got five. But that still gives you five platforms to serve. And on top of that, we also got the web. And there, the great thing about the web is that it's already accessible everywhere, right? We don't have to deal with, this is an app, this is a website that can only be accessed on Linux or only on Windows or only on Mac. And the question here is that, do you really have the kind of time and money to spend to employ a developer to work on each of these platforms separately? Because sure, you could have an iOS developer that can probably rock out some Swift or Objective-C that works as a macOS app, and you might be able to find a Android developer that could build you a Java app that runs on the desktop. But is this really going to give you this true native experience that you were going for in the first place when you decided to rather build native apps for everything? Because I don't really think so. The other thing is not reinventing the wheel. I think we all kind of bet more and more on open source technology. Even large enterprises like Microsoft have a huge bet on open source now. And the whole idea is that we don't reinvent the wheel constantly and we kind of gather from the community, right? Why not do the same thing with your internal code base? Companies like Dropbox or Spotify, they actually write their core business logic in C++ and then share that across all platforms. But I think nowadays it's easier for someone to find a proficient JavaScript or TypeScript developer than someone that is really an expert on C++. So it should be at least a viable option for you to kind of share your knowledge using that, or like reuse code. The other thing is consistency. So we always say an app should feel like an app, but an app really should feel welcoming on the one hand to a user that is used to the platform, but also a user that is used to the app, which means that if someone uses your iOS app and they never used your product in general, they should feel at home. they should know how to navigate the application, and you shouldn't come up with those weird paradigmas. But it should also mean that if someone had an Android phone and used your app there, and they're using it on your friend's phone, they should feel at home as well. So you should kind of have a consistency on both sides, and that's really easy to do with web technology or like technology in general if you already use the same code base everywhere. Spotify, again, does this great by, if you ever looked at the app and realized that when you use it on iOS and Android, like they switch the toggles, they kind of rearrange a few things, but overall you know how to navigate that thing if you ever used the app before. So why is this difficult? Why is it so difficult to develop hybrid apps? Well, first of all, it's still web development, and web development can be hard. The most difficult thing about web development, I don't think, is actually CSS. It's the fact that we have to cater to a bunch of different browsers and a bunch of different rendering engines that all decide they're going to do it differently. And contrary to normal web scenarios, with hybrid apps, you have the problem that the rendering engine is actually connected to the operating system. And that means that if the user installs a minor patch that fixes the rendering engine, your app might break. If your app works well on Android but has some weird bug on iOS, you can't tell the user, well, mitigate this issue by switching to Android for now. That just doesn't work. It's not like switching browsers, you know. You can't have multiple ones. And the other thing is, just like with any other software development, performance is still important. And with web, if you have to cater to multiple rendering engines, this can be hard because your focus is on something else than performance in that moment. But there are certainly great apps. Two of them are Gmail and Evernote. They're doing a great job. Both of them are hybrid apps that are using web technology. And probably some of you didn't even notice, because I think they're doing such a great job that you don't really realize that those apps are hybrid apps. And that's really the point of hybrid apps. A good hybrid app isn't recognizable as a hybrid app. It's just an app. It's just an app on your phone. The problem comes when you look at bad hybrid apps, and that's the Barclay app on my phone is my favorite example. So that thing, if you navigate with it, feel free to come by later and have a look at it. If you navigate with this thing, it shows you every time you click something, it shows you a spinner. And additionally, it just looks really outdated, and it doesn't even do those small things that native apps do, like changing the color of the title bar, the status bar. So I think those are the problem, because people tend to associate hybrid apps with these kind of apps and not these kind of apps. It's this what sticks in your mind, because it's a bad experience. You know, you always remember a bad experience over a good experience. And the problem here is, again, it's the fact that you have to deal with multiple rendering engines. You have to do traditional web development, which can be painful. But while I think the future of hybrid apps on mobile is still kind of vague, I think there is a bright future for some other type of hybrid apps, and those are desktop hybrid apps. Because slowly our desktop is actually being flooded with these apps. The most common example is Spotify. So while the mobile apps are native, the desktop app is actually a hybrid app. So they're using, again, the C++ library that they wrote for their core business logic, like playback, et cetera. But all the user interface is written using web technologies. And if you don't believe me, you can actually inspect the source code, at least on Mac, very easily by just clicking on Show Package Content, and you will find a lot of CSS. But you might have also used Visual Studio Code or Atom, which are both hybrid apps as well. So both of these code editors are hybrid apps. In the case of Atom, this allowed them to claim themselves as a hackable editor, which doesn't mean that it's insecure or something. It's just very easy to customize because it's web technologies. If you don't like how it looks like, just write CSS and change everything. And that's, I think, the really cool part about it. Like you don't have to spend a major time on making this thing customizable, because it's customizable already by out of the box. And then there are two more apps. One is Slack. For Slack, it made a lot of sense, because they already had a web client, and pushing that down to the desktop for the users to have more comfort with it was fairly easy because you just bundle it up and ship it. And then there's Hyper. Hyper is a terminal for Mac. I think it's coming for Windows and Linux soon. That one allows you, again, to be very hackable, very extendable, that you can add whatever you like so that you can turn the terminal into whatever you think suits your needs and not what is the out-of-the-box experience. And in fact, this slide deck is a hybrid app as well, and I'm going to dig into that in a second, why I actually did this. But all of these projects, or most of these projects, are based on the same project called Electron. And Electron started off as a project by GitHub called Atom Shell, and as the name suggests, it was actually the shell of Atom that Atom was kind of built on. And you can imagine it like the love child between Node.js and Chromium, or the Chromium rendering engine, because you can use Node.js across the whole base for your logic. All the JavaScript that you write is executed through Node.js, but then at the same time, it renders the user interface with Chromium. Why would you do that? Well, first of all, it makes sense considering that both of these technologies have their origin in the Google Chrome project. So Node.js is based on V8, which is the JavaScript engine that comes in Chrome. And then the other thing is the Chromium rendering engine, as the name suggests, is the rendering engine that Chrome uses. And since Chrome or Chromium is cross-platform, that means that basically the foundation that we're taking here is already cross-platform. It compiles on everything it runs there, so we're safe there. The other great benefit is you ship the rendering engine. And that might sound weird in the beginning because that's a bit more overload, but we're on the desktop, so we can give a bit more overload there if we get a huge benefit, and we do, because we're under control of what is being displayed. That means that when you're developing the app, and it looks like that, you ship it, and it will look like that. You don't have to do the typical web development thing of running a bunch of tests on like 10 different browsers and 10 different operating systems, and then look how it looks like. It's that thing. You're packaging that up and shipping it. And I think that's a really cool thing here. The other thing that is really cool is it allows you to do random stuff like this. So I mentioned that this is a hybrid app actually loaded. And I mentioned that it runs Node.js, which means that I have access to Node.js modules, such as the file system or child processes, which means I can spawn child processes and I can write to the disk. So I build a code editor. So I can write some Python here. It's not like I do that a lot. So I know pretty much exactly this line to prove that it's Python. So if I run this now, what will happen is it will write it to the file system, and then it will execute the normal Python command on my computer and pipe the output back to the screen. Ah, damn it, I typed on the wrong screen. I was wondering why it doesn't work. Cool. So let's run this. And there you can see it's actually 2.7, which is the thing that comes by default with Mac OS. So this is exactly the Python interpreter that is on my machine. It's not like I loaded some JavaScript version of it or something. This is just the normal Python interpreter. All right, let's talk a bit about how Electron works. And this is a confusing diagram. I'm sorry for that, but I figured I'd rather take one that you can easily find again, because this is part of the API demos. The main part that is important to remember here is that there are two types of processes. There is a main process, which is the JavaScript that handles your application lifecycle. It's what is being started when you start your application. And then that one can spawn rendering processes, which are browser windows, effectively, that run then as separate processes. And you can communicate between the two using something called IPC, so an inter-process communicator, because some things can only be done on either of the two processes. But I'm going to cover that. With that, enough teasing, and I'm going to dig into some code. All right, let me switch from cloning. There we go. So what I have here is, so first of all, this is Hyper, by the way, so that's the terminal that I was mentioning before. And so as you can see, currently I have a Node modules folder which only has one project, one package installed, which is Electron, because I didn't want to rely on the internet connection here. And I'm gonna open this with Visual Studio Code. And I hope it's readable and it didn't reset. Yep, so that works. Cool. So as you can see, this is the package JSON. It only has Electron installed version 1.4.10. I actually used Yarn for it, which is something like the Node Package Manager. So that's why I have the other file. But aside of that, we don't have anything in the project. So we start off by actually modifying our package JSON a bit, because overall, you can still think of this as a Node application. The first thing that we need is obviously a name. So let's call it Tech Summit. And then we need a version. So this is 1.0. And then a main. So this is the entry point of our application, which is going to be main.js for us. And then one more thing that I'm going to do is I'm going to specify npm scripts, specifically a start script. So the idea behind this is that when you install the Electron package, it will install a pre-compiled version of Electron. So that means that it will download a binary that you can execute on the respective platform to start off your Electron application. So this is typically in node modules, and then .bin/Electron, and then dot would execute that. So it's the thing down here, this thing. So this is what typically would execute that, but I don't want to write that every time. So I'm going to alias that and actually just write in here electron dot, because in the npm scripts, node modules /.bin is actually part of the path already temporarily. So this is a really nice, neat solution so that I can only write npm start and start off my project. All right, so with that said, we need to create a main.js file to actually write our application. So this is just normal Node. I'm going to use ES2015, which is the latest JavaScript standard, or it's ES2016 now, but those were two features. But effectively, I can use things like const or let or something. If anyone has not an idea of what's going on at any point in time, feel free to either scream or raise your hand or just run out of the door, and I don't know. I'm more than happy to help, though. So I'm going to grab a couple of things from the Electron project package. So I'm going to grab the app and the browser window class, because those are the two that we need for our initial application. The first thing we need to do is create a function called createWindow. And outside of it, I'm going to initialize or declare a variable called window or win. The reason why I do that is because if I don't declare it in there, but instead put it inside the function, the garbage collector is just going to be like, never mind, I'm going to sweep this away, and then the application is closed. So we put it outside to verify that the application doesn't close itself. And then we need to create a new browser window instance. We can specify things like the width or height. So I'm going to just specify both as 600. Let's do a squared window. And then we need to load a URL, because this is kind of like a browser, right? So just like on the browser, I can actually access something from the file system. So in my case, I'm going to use the template strings here and then specify that I'm going to load it from the directory we're currently in. I'm going to load the index.html file. And then the last thing I'm going to do in this function is I'm saying if the window is actually being closed, just assign window to null. So this should trigger the garbage collector and just close the whole app. With that, the last thing here I need to say is when the app is ready, just trigger the create window function, and we're good. So now I can write down here npm start, and this will trigger the application. As you see nothing. That's kind of on purpose in this case, because we didn't create the index.html file yet. To do so, no, I'm fine with this version. I'm going to create a new index.html. So this is normal HTML. I could either write this whole HTML blob with like head and body and stuff. But the great thing about HTML is that the browser is kind of smart in this aspect, and I can just ignore that part. So I'm just going to write straight the body content. In my case, I'm going to create four different divs with a headline in it. Sorry, this way. So this is Emmet. It just helps me to do this. And then I'm going to write something like, hello, Microsoft Technical Summit. Woohoo. So I'm going to save this. I didn't change anything in the main.js, which means I do not need to restart the program. Only if I change something in the main process, I need to restart it. So in this case, I can just do a refresh with Command-R on a Mac or F5 on Windows. And there you can see we have our content now, so we loaded that file. So far, so good. I said the great thing about the whole thing is that we have one rendering engine, which means I can style stuff. So let's do some styling. So first of all, I'm going to give these a couple of names. So I'm just going to go and do like red, green, blue, and yellow. I'm not sure if someone has an idea what's going on here. But let's create some classes here. So red is obviously background red. Let's be descriptive. Green is background. Let's do sea green. Blue is background dodge blue, dodger blue. And then yellow is just a normal yellow. So far, so good. Let's reload this. That doesn't look nice. All right, so I figured it would be nice to teach you more than just Electron. So I'm going to do a couple of cool things that you can do with Electron. I said we're shipping the rendering engine, so I can do anything, which means I can turn on flags, for example. So we're in Chrome. We're going to add a command line switch to this whole thing. There's this beautiful command line switch that I had to alias because I typed it 5 times wrong. Enable experimental web platform features. That basically means let's use the coolest, newest stuff. And the newest, coolest kit on the block in CSS is CSS Grids. Has anyone heard of CSS Grids? Has anyone used CSS Grids? All right, so I'm going to show you some CSS Grids now. All right, so obviously we have 4 divs. That are colored in red, green, blue, and yellow. So what are we going to do? We're going to create the Microsoft logo. And this is fairly straightforward. I'm just going to do a couple of resets first to make sure that we don't have any artificial margins or something and that everything in the body stretches to the full height and width. And then what we're going to do is we're going to specify a new rule for the body. And all we need to do is we need to specify display grid, as easy as that. And then what we need to do is we need to specify how many columns and how many rows this thing is going to have. That means I'm just going to write grid template rows. I'm going to say, OK, take 2 rows, and they should take equal amount of space. So this FR is fraction. It's a new unit in CSS. And then we can do the same thing with column. And then one fraction. So that means that we have now a grid of 2 columns and 2 rows that take the equal amount of space. So if this window is squared, those should be squared. If they aren't, it's going to kind of stretch in the respective region. So I refresh this. Oh. OK, so I said I changed something in the renderer process, so you got to restart. Boom. All right, so far, so good. That's how easy you can use CSS grids. There's way more you can do with CSS grids. I'm not going to focus on that, but I want to center vertically and horizontally the text. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to say in every div, let's use Flexbox for that. Again, we don't have to worry about vendor prefixes or anything, because if it works in this moment, it will work when we ship it. And then what I'm going to do is justify content center and align items center. I go back here, reload, boom. How much time would you usually spend on vertically and horizontally centering something? All right, so we got this. That's cool. That's just some CSS magic. So I said we're using Node everywhere, right? Which means that I should be able to write script tags into this as well and just execute some JavaScript. So let's replace the top one here with three paragraphs that each have a script tag. And we're going to use old school document write. And we're going to check out quickly which versions of stuff we're using. So we're interested in the version of Electron. And then since this is Node, we have a process, a global variable, and that one has a versions part where we can say, give me the version of Electron. Similarly, I can do document.write and check out the Chrome version. So this is useful when you're wondering, what features does this version of Electron actually support? You can look up which things that version of Chrome supports. So that's Chrome. And then the last thing is document.write Node, because obviously we would like to know what features we can use as well. So that's Node, save. And now if I refresh this, you can see there are the versions. This looks a bit weird because I use paragraphs and they shouldn't be next to each other, but that's the result of Flexbox. We can quickly fix this by just saying that flex direction is actually columns. So put everything below each other rather than next to each other, which is the default behavior of Flexbox, and now this looks a bit better. So you can see we're using Electron 1.4, we're using Chrome 53, and then Node 6.5, which is the stable version of Node right now. Cool. So that means we can write some more JavaScript now. One thing that is always nice when you're writing hybrid apps is obviously you want to have more things you can do than you were able to do on the browser, because that's one reason why you're building a hybrid app in the first place. So one thing that would be nice are notifications, you know, that just slide in from the side. So we can do that. So I'm going to create a script tag here, and I'm going to just write the function here. I'm going to create a function called notify. And we're just going to declare an iterator above it as well. And all we need to do now to trigger a notification is write new notification. Give it a title, like notification number i++, so we increment it afterwards. And then we can give it a body as well, like some content here. And we save this. Now all we need to do is trigger this. So if I create a button, click me. That sounds like clickbait. And then write on click. I haven't written this for ages. On click. All right. So now that we have this, I go back here, refresh. I have a button here. And now you need to look at top right corner when I click this. Woo! And another one, and another one, and another one. So now we have notifications. For the people who have been attending the PWA talk, I'm not going to give you guys access to this, and it doesn't go down anyways. So you can't spam me. Yeah.
Can you also use the web notifications, and they will be mapped to the system notifications by Electron? Or what does if you use web notifications?
Well, the web notifications are still using, I think, the notification class, so it should be fine. I haven't tried it personally. It should work, though. I mean, it's just Chrome, right? So whatever you do in Chrome kind of maps to the same thing. Cool. So we have this. The next thing, what do you typically do when you do web development and you need to debug something? You open the DevTools, right? So this is a browser, which means I can press Command-Alt-I and open the DevTools. You can turn this off, but by default, this is always enabled. So this is useful. I could have also clicked Win. I think there's somewhere in View, Toggle DevTools. So you can also trigger that from there. Cool. So we have this. Let's go back to the code editor that I wrote earlier. So I said I can access the file system, right? So let's require the file system module. And then we're going to read some content here. FS read file sync. And then we're just going to read the package JSON in the current directory. So now I have content. I can add this actually to my blue thing. Well, this works as well. But let's do this. So I can write this in here in my blue field. So that's a bit small. There you go. So this is what we just wrote, read from the hard drive, which is exactly the thing we wrote earlier. You can also do other things, like, as I said, we can actually execute child processes. So that's, we just grab the exec function, and then we can do a bunch of stuff here. So we can, for example, run ls minus l on this whole thing. And then we need to grab the std out. Let's write this to content. And then we can execute this same thing we did earlier. And now we have the output here of the file system check. Cool. So far, so good. Let's refresh this. Now that we have that, that's kind of cool because we managed to access the file system and play around with that, which is already something that you wouldn't be able to do with a classical browser application. Important here is you can load, obviously, web content in here as well. In fact, there is a location.href here, so you can see that's the current location where I have this stuff. And that means I could also write location.href equal and then set it to some path from the just the internet. There is a thing about this, though. If you load this in, that page has the same capabilities than the page had that I just wrote, right? Which means it can access the file system, it can execute stuff. So that's not really great. So you should never really load these kind of things in there. You could put an iframe in, but that has the same permission, so not worth it. There is, though, a special tag called WebView, and this WebView behaves like an iframe, but it's more like, do you remember how you embedded Flash or Java or something into a website? It's more like that. It's scoped, it can't do anything. It's like it's sandboxed. It behaves like a normal browser rather than this browser on steroids that can access your file system. So just be careful that you never put an iframe in there or load something directly with window.location. By default, if you actually click a web link or something, it will, like a URL, I think it pops it up in the browser anyways. Or it creates a new window, a safe window or something. So on that side, you should be fine. But you should really load this stuff into a web view if you're planning to include web content. All right. So I said there are two types of processes, and we kind of wrote in both, but we need to communicate sometimes between them as well. One typical thing why we would want to do this is when we want to spawn native dialogues, like something went really bad and I want to show a native error dialogue. So we can do this. For that, I'm going to go back into my main.js. I'm going to, on the one hand, reference the IPC main, and then which is the IPC on the main site, main process, and then I'm going to grab the dialogue service as well. And what we're going to do is write IPC main on, and we need to listen on some channel for messages. So I'm just going to call mine critical message. And then we get an event as well as whatever we pass in there. So I'm going to pass in a message whenever I write to that IPC channel. So in there, all we need to do is write dialog show error box, and then we can give it a title again, something like something went really bad. Cool. And then we can give it a content, so I'm just going to pass in the message. Save this, and this goes back to whenever you change the main, restart your process. Let's full screen this again, open the dev tools. By the way, you can plus this. This is the great thing about CSS grids, right? Like, I'm increasing this, and there's no weird shift. All right, so now in order to send something, we can grab the IPC by requiring from the Electron module the IPC renderer. The one thing that is important to notice when building Electron is with Electron is that even though you're requiring from the same module in both cases, there are things that aren't available on either site. So that's why you need to use, for example, dialog isn't available here, so I have to use it in main and then pipe over. This can sometimes, when you start off with something, cause a couple of problems. The documentation typically highlights very well where it's available and where it isn't. So you can always check there, but this sometimes, at least when I started off, kind of triggered a couple of issues. And now we can send something. So I'm going to write to a critical message, and I'm going to write something like, hello from the summit. All right, and now you can see this is actually a native window that is being triggered. So I can't do anything around here behind it right now. It just took front place. Cool. So this way you can communicate. There are two ways you can communicate. You can communicate asynchronously or synchronously. So this was more of an async way. If I would want to reply to this, I would have to actually then send something back, which is what you want to do if you have to do computations that take a bit of time. You don't want to block the thread. If you do something typical like ping pong, you know, you already know that this is cached. It's literally just looking up a variable or something. You can do also synchronous communication where you can then block it. With asynchronous, you would always have to write to a different channel afterwards, which means that you would have to create way more listeners. Cool. This is how much I'm going to do live coding. There is a great thing if you want to explore things that you can do with Electron. This is called the Electron API demos. It's an actual app built with Electron that not only shows you what you can do, but it also shows you exactly the code that it used to do that, which means I showed you how you can create a window. This app shows you how to create a frameless window. So this thing doesn't have the title bar or something. If I go really into the top corner, then I can drag it around. But there's like, yeah, I can't move it here. I can select stuff. It's a normal like resizable window and stuff. But overall, it's a frameless window. And if I close the button, you can see here the code that it actually used to trigger this. So it's a normal button that it attached to the event listener, and then it spans a new browser window with frame faults, and then does the normal things that I already showed you earlier. Cool. So, and this is available in the renderer. It is kind of in the renderer process. It's a trick because it like attaches to the it grabs remote, which is kind of a reference to the main process. But you can see up here that it tells you that the process, this, all of these features are available in the main process. You can customize the menu. So you see up here, this is the typical application menu. So if we would customize that, there's one entry here that they only added. They kind of duplicated the default menu because that's what you unfortunately need to do. And then they added one more, which is this separator, and then the app menu demo, which is under review. So you can see it up here. So this one is literally just for if you click on it, it spawns this dialogue, which says like, yeah, this was just to show you, you can create an entry yourself. And if you look at the code, this is literally what it does. So I think this app is really cool because it shows you all of these things with you just being able to copy paste the code. It's sometimes a bit of an overhead of what you actually need. As for like the code lines, but that's because it's in the context of this is what the app used to do that. So it gives you a bit more guidance of, hey, this is how you could actually combine the two things. You can register global key shortcuts. So this is how I actually got to Electron. I was listening to YouTube playlists at work, and I was sick of not being able to use the media keys for changing the music. So I built a small Electron app that would register global key listeners and just load the YouTube videos in a web view, and then use the YouTube JavaScript API to kind of play, pause, and stuff like that. So that was a very easy, quick thing. And the same way you can build here your own global key shortcuts. The great thing here is you see it says command or control. This doesn't mean that on a Mac, for example, you can press either. It means that when you're on Mac, it's command and else it's control. So you get, for example, command C on Mac and control C on Windows or Linux. So that's really neat because it goes back to making people familiar with the place that they're at. Other things that you can do, I showed you system dialog, so you can trigger a normal file directory thing. You can put stuff in a tray. So the first app that I built was actually a tray app. So this one, the tray in Mac is the one up here. The tray on Windows is the taskbar down in the bottom. If I click this, it actually adds an entry. So it just added this thing. So if I click remove, it kicks it out again. And again, the code is right here. So you can take it. In this case, it requires code in the main process and in the renderer process, even though the renderer one is the one that sets the icon. There's much more you can do, like clipboard access, launching a protocol handler. So this is useful if you want to do these magic links that Slack, for example, does for login, so that if your customer is in a browser and clicks a link and has the app installed, it will open the app and navigate to whatever you implemented. So you can specify your own protocol using this. And again, it shows you how to do that. There's other stuff like taking screenshots, printing PDFs, lots of stuff. And the whole thing is written in Electron and is open source, so you can read the whole source code anyways. All right. With that, let me switch back to... This and... There we go. All right. I think I gave a... short overview here, but if you want to grab any of the resources or get additional information, you can either go to the GitHub that I put up there, or the bit.ly link below actually goes straight to the resources.markdown file that has a list of, first of all, the things that I described, as well as the Electron demo API app and a bunch of other stuff. The GitHub project itself, so the resources file is in the GitHub project, but I'm also going to push the slides in there as the whole Electron app, as well as the demo app that I just built. I'm going to push that later as well. All right, with that, let's wrap it up. So obviously, this sounds all cool, but there are pros and cons to this. As for pros, if you already build a web app, or if you already have a web app, if you definitely need one. In all of these cases, this allows you to really have a high code reusage. And that's really a huge benefit of this. It's super easy to use this on multiple platforms. For the people that attended the PWA talk that was right before this, they already saw this. But there are scripts that allow you to package the whole thing up either into a .app file for Mac, into a binary for Linux, as well as into an .exe file for Windows. So you can package the whole thing up, and then there are even scripts that build your installers around it. So you can really ship this thing. There are also on the Electron website, there are instructions of how you can submit this to the App Store or the Windows Store. So you can really reach all of these platforms. And additionally, in the case of Electron, you are in control of the rendering engine more than in any other hybrid app approach. And that's really the powerful thing, because when you develop it, you don't have to worry about it anymore that it might change because the user has a different operating system or just updated their browser. Because the only time that this will change is when you update the browser, because you're in control of it. As for cons, you still have to write performant web applications. You can spend a bit more time on this now when you don't have to worry about things like feature flags or vendor prefixes or all these kind of weird things. You can focus a bit more on writing performant applications. It's still a bit tricky, though, if you didn't do much web development before. It's still sometimes weird with web development, especially with CSS and stuff like that. But there are more and more projects that pop up that allow you to also get already pre-built user interface components that are focusing more on animations and performance and looks and feels, so that you don't have to worry about that part anymore and you don't have to be a designer. Unfortunately, the best one is not an Electron project. I think you can certainly load it in Electron, though, with a bit of work. I've never tried it, but that one is Ionic. Ionic is actually a project for mobile hybrid apps. that was founded by a bunch of designers that really focus on 60 frames per second animations and having user interface components that are based on Angular that look on every platform like they should. So without you doing any changes, it will move the icon bar to the top when you're on Android and to the bottom when you're on iOS, as an example, or other things. But that one is a mobile hybrid app framework. One last thing before we wrap it up. I think you all are sick of this sentence, but I would really appreciate some feedback. This can be either through the conference app. If you really don't want to download the conference app, you can also send me a text message to that phone number answering that question on a scale from 0 to 10. How likely is it that you would recommend this talk to a friend or a colleague? This is actually a Twilio phone number, so you won't spam my phone. but I will read the messages later, and I would really appreciate them. The phone number is on the next slide as well. With that, thank you, everyone. My name is Dominic. I'm a developer evangelist for Twilio. And yeah, if you have any questions, feel free to ask them. Yep, I think we have a microphone. Malte, do you want to run?
So, what logic would you do in the main process, and what logic would you do in the render process?
So, the thing is, the main process is kind of limited on its potential as well. So, one trick that people do is they just spin up windows that don't load like any actual HTML or something that are hidden, and then do the computation. So that's one way you can do multi-threading, for example. Because if you would do all the heavy computation on the main process, you block that process as well, right? So I think you should keep your render process as kind of lightweight as you could. The main process is really for things that are very close to the operating system. So for example, one thing that I do in one project is I'm literally running an Express server in the background, and that one is running on the main process because it's fine. Like that one doesn't have like a continuous loop of computation. But if there would be something that you have to compute that takes a bit longer, totally spin that off into a separate thread. Because this is like just like normal Chrome stuff, right? Every tab has its own process, so you can leverage the same thing. All right. Another question? Cool. I think then that's it.
Thank you, Dominic. Please don't just send your positive feedback to the phone number and the negative feedback in the feedback form, because this will mean we won't invite him again. So just put your positive and negative feedback into both channels.
Thank you. Thank you.